Do you ever struggle with the question, if God is good, why is there suffering? We unpack this timeless question in a free chapter download from Why You Can Believe. It's called Why Does God Allow Suffering? And it's honest, hopeful, and deeply personal. From free will to a broken world, to the way suffering can lead us to God, this chapter will equip you with real biblical insight. Get your free download today at premierinsight.org/resources. Again, that's premierinsight.org/resources.
Good afternoon and welcome along to Unbelievable with me, Justin Brierley. This is the show that brings Christians and non-Christians together every week here on Premier Christian Radio as part of Faith Explored. And looking forward to today's show as we ask, does science need God? I'll be introducing my guests in a moment's time. If you want to find out more about the programme, do go to our website, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. You'll find links there to the most recent editions of the show, the podcast. You can find Unbelievable, the conference on DVD, took place in London back in May, now available to be dispatched on DVD and MP3 CD and via digital download. Links there to where you can find out more about it. And of course, Unbelievable the book, available now, telling the story of the show and why I, after 10 years of having the conversations with atheists, agnostics and skeptics, why I'm still a Christian. And thanks to those who've been sending in reviews, giving me their feedback on the book, having read it now. And later on, I'll be sharing some of the comments that came in from those who entered a competition to win a signed copy of the book. Now, they didn't win, but they did share some lovely sentiments about the programme. I'll be reading out some of those later, along with other pieces of feedback. After Unbelievable today, you can hear myself on the profile, sitting down with Alistair McGrath. He was one of my guests on last week's show. We'll be going in depth about his new book, The Great Mystery, and about his own life and faith. Right now, though, it's time to get into today's show. You're unbelievable. Well, today on Unbelievable, we're asking, does science need God? And answering yes to that question today, Dave Hutchings and Tom McLeish, co-authors of a new book, Let There Be Science, Why God Loves Science and Science Needs God, published by Lion. David Hutchings is a physics teacher, and Tom McLeish is professor of physics at Durham University, also chairs the Royal Society's Education Committee. Well, they're both Christians, and their book examines the story of science and the part Christianity has played in it. And they believe that the Christian worldview has actually fueled some of the biggest leaps forward made in science over the centuries. So this should be an interesting one, because answering no to the question, does science need God? I'm delighted to also be joined today by Susie Sheehy, a particle physicist at Oxford University. Susie says that science is fundamentally a human activity, and that we ought to examine the basic nature of what that means, independent of faith. I'm really looking forward to today's conversation. Welcome along to the programme. David, Tom and Susie, welcome along.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
It's great to have you all on. Susie, you're joining us from an entirely different time zone, excitingly. You're out doing some research stuff in Japan, and I'm going to come to you in a moment to talk to you about your own background, which looks utterly fascinating to me. But we'll begin with Dave and Tom joining me in studio here in London. Welcome along. It's been a little while in the making, this show, but I'm really glad that we managed to bring you both down. You're based up in Durham a lot of the time, aren't you,
Tom?
Right,
yeah.
And you're quite far-flung as well from the capital, Dave.
I'm up in York, so, and Tom actually lives
in
York.
Yeah, I live in York, so Dave, yes, and I bump into each other.
So you do see each other. To start with you, Dave, you're a physics teacher, which means you get to actually teach this stuff on the ground to young and inquiring minds. What got you interested in science, though?
I think you have to track it back really a long way to when you're very, very young and you first start asking questions about the world around you, and different people end up taking a different route in those. So some people perhaps answer them by pursuing art or music, mm-hmm, or literature. Those are the big questions, and for me, I wanted to know how things worked. That's how it started off.
And along the way with your interest in science, was your Christian faith ever at odds with that, or did anyone ever question you, the fact that you're a Christian and working in science?
I don't think I found it was at odds growing up until I hit sixth form. And at that point, you're doing higher level science. The idea of science and God being opposed to each other somehow starts to crystallise. I went to a church where me and my sister were really pretty much the only teenagers, and there weren't any Christians at school. So I think I did it in isolation, and my friends would gang up on me to hit me with all of their best arguments, and I think probably my answers had to start coming from books.
Right.
Really.
So you turned to books.
I turned to books. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, you've written your own book now, which is rather exciting, on the back of obviously those years you've had of experience looking at these questions. And you've done that in cooperation with Tom McLeish. Tom, welcome along to the show.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Tell us a little of your background, because obviously you've been around in this field a bit longer than Dave.
Thanks to radio, you can't immediately tell that. Yeah, great. Well, I suppose, yeah, for me, I mean, people ask me since when I have been a scientist. I think it must have been since when I've been about 2.5 years old.
Really?
I think, yeah. We are talking the 60s here. We are talking the moon shots, and astronomy was my great love. I remember the first time I saw Saturn's ring through a telescope and was overwhelmed by the beauty. My grandmother, actually, very important influence on me, was did one of the first women to do a biology degree at London University.
Oh, wow.
And she gave me a little microscope, which I remember using to look at, you know, slices of carrot and flies' wings and things, and just loving that. And just the idea of doing an experiment. I mean, although I've become what's called a theoretical physicist now, I do the math side. I remember doing an experiment, literally would send a little shiver of frisson up my spine. So I've always adored the idea of science and finding out about the natural world.
And how has faith gone alongside that in your own journey?
Well, you know, very naturally, really. So I became Christian my young adult life. And I have to say, I wasn't aware for some time that anyone thought there was a conflict or a problem between the two. I was certainly aware that some of the greatest scientists I knew of, people like Newton, Copernicus, Galileo, Kelvin, Maxwell, Gilmore, were very devout believers. I never saw a problem until later on other people started asking the question, well, how do you reconcile your science with your Christian faith then? And it sounded then, and it still sounds to me now, a bit like the have you stopped beating your wife yet question. It just assumes stuff I don't believe in, so I want to get behind that question.
And you've got this role with the Royal Society, which is, you know, very important in terms of public education and so on.
Yes, that's true. And sometimes people ask me, look, you know, because there are some quite high profile fellows of the Royal Society who do see a conflict, as you probably know. In fact, one of my predecessors chairing the education work, Michael Royce, had
he was criticised by Richard Dawkins.
He was very badly criticised, and it's uniformly just about recognised as being not one of the Royal Society's finest moments, that little chapter. But no, I'm passionate for education, passionate for science education. But actually, I rather suspect I might be agreeing with Susie a lot when she's saying that science is a deeply human activity. Because the reason that... So I wrote a book called Faith and Wisdom in Science, which is a predecessor to the book I've written with Dave. Well, Dave's written with me, sort of standing by, cheering him on. Which was motivated. It isn't really a science religion book. It's motivated by trying to get the message across that science is a deeply human activity, and that was my issue. Most people saw science as being a bit geeky, a bit behind lab doors, a bit dressed up in white coats, you know, Big Bang Theory, the American show is very funny, but do we really want to have parties with these people? And for me, science has always been, as Dave has also sort of pointed us to, it's in the same basket for me as writing literature and music and song and all the things that make us human.
It expresses the kind of fundamental aspect of who we are in some level.
Absolutely.
Dave, why did you want to write this specific book and this particular theme of showing the connection of Christian faith with scientific progress over the decades and centuries, in fact?
There is a long version and a short version. The short version is basically, it's a case of mistaken identity.
you were never supposed to write this book. Is that the idea?
Well, I mean, I would like to think that God intended for me to write the book, but I certainly didn't, and I don't think Tom did originally either.
This was all just one terrible mistake.
It was a misunderstanding.
Well, the short version, let me make it very short, is that some people from Lion Hudson read Faith and Wisdom in Science, which was my original book, kind of written for people at degree level education of some kind or another, and so it'd be great to have this message message written for a broader audience, yes. broader readership, and particularly for people at school. And I said, that's a fabulous idea, but I think I need help to write at that level. So go and find help. And through some interesting twists and turns of the plot, Dave and I ended up together writing this book. And Dave's the perfect co-author.
As it turns out, as it is the person.
Yeah, he has to say that because 50% of the royalties go his way. So if he doesn't support me wholeheartedly, he's out of pocket.
I would just say it anyway.
Yeah, but anyway, this is how it came about. And obviously something you're passionate about communicating, I guess, in the classroom, that there needn't be this supposed, you know, the conflict between science and God.
As a teacher, I think teaching is almost in your blood. I think some people teach naturally, and it wouldn't really matter so much what subject they were teaching. It's the desire to communicate and interact and see ideas grow. And for me, I happen to be teaching science. But it wouldn't have to be science. It's a dynamic in the classroom that's the most interesting thing. And I had started to find throughout year after year after year that students would say, when they found out I believed in God, but you're a science teacher.
Yeah.
Now, I don't think they would have said that to an English teacher or to a music teacher.
Mm.
So there is this idea in our collective consciousness that somehow science and religion don't mix. And I had that conversation so many times with students that it seemed very natural suddenly when this opportunity came out of nowhere to start putting some of those ideas down on paper that had been aired already in the classroom a lot.
What a great way to start the book as well. And thank you very much for both joining me in studio today. Susie also joins us on the line from Japan because her work takes her all over the world. She is I've described you as a particle physicist. I'm not quite sure if that's the correct term, Susie. Susie Sheehy has been involved in physics, though, for a long time and currently at Oxford Physics as well. Susie, welcome along to the programme.
Thank you.
It's great to have you on. Susie, tell us a little bit about how you began in science, and I know that you've been championing the role of women generally in science and research. Tell us about your own journey, if you would.
Sure, yeah. So my own journey in science, I don't think I ever set out to be a scientist. In fact, I don't think I knew being a scientist was a career when I was even in high school and I was studying mostly science subjects, and I enjoyed it. I was good at it. I enjoyed it. I understood things. Things seemed intuitive to me. I was quite an inquisitive kid. I used to spend my spare time doing things like building model solar powered cars for out of school competitions. So yeah, I was a paid up geek. And no one really told me that being a scientist and doing research and answering questions that you had about the world around you could actually be a job. So I went to university and studied both science and engineering. So this is back in Australia, in Melbourne, where I'm from originally. And about 2 years into my degree, I remember this lecture in physics where I asked a question of the lecturer that I thought, was the next obvious question in what he was teaching, and maybe I was just being thick. And he turned around and he said, "Well, actually, we don't know the answer to that. That's actually something that I'm working on in my research." And I was really grabbed by that. I was like, "Well, hang on. So, first of all, we don't have all the answers." I knew that already, right, before second year university, obviously. But I don't think it was quite obvious to me that I could ask those questions, that I had the capacity to ask those questions. So from there, I think my interest really developed in terms of asking questions about the world and trying to answer them using science. I'm actually, you said particle physicist. I'm an accelerator physicist, so I actually work on particle accelerators themselves and the beams and how they behave. So I literally spend all day, every day, thinking about and dealing with things that we can't observe directly with our own bodies, which I realize for most people is a bit of an unusual day job.
Yeah. I mean, just describe for us these accelerators, because these are generally what we, well, the biggest probably example we have, I think, is the CERN accelerator, which I know people like Brian Cox have worked on and so on. But they come in all kind of sizes, don't they? These round sort of rigs that you can then speed up these particles to extraordinary speeds and so on. So for the really lay people like me, just explain what that's about and what you're trying to do with that kind of work.
Sure. So the whole idea of a particle accelerator is exactly what it says on the tin. We're taking subatomic particles from inside the atom and literally giving them energy. So as you say, you can do that in many different forms, either sort of a straight line accelerator or circular ones, and they range from tabletop size to the 27-kilometer long behemoth that is the Large Hadron Collider. And overall, there's about 35,000 accelerators in the world, and around half of them are used for medical applications, things like cancer treatment, and most of the other half are actually used in industry to do jobs that you just wouldn't think an accelerator is involved in, like making the chips that go in all of our computers and mobile phones.
How interesting.
So they're actually kind of essential to our everyday lives, and yet kind of invisible and hidden. But what they really rely on is the sort of basic physics of the 20th century, electromagnetism and things like that, as well as our emerging knowledge of particle physics and how we can actually rip these particles out of the atom and what we can do with them after that. So really, they're a tool that we can use to either directly influence things or to investigate the universe. It's such a wide spectrum, it's hard to even say what they can't do.
Well, this has obviously been your life's work thus far, and continues to, I'm sure, get you out of bed every morning. But you champion the role of women in science and research. Why historically has science been underrepresented, would you say, in this area?
That's a very good question. I think you're probably better off asking a historian that rather than a working physicist. Mostly gender stereotypes and gender roles in society. It just wasn't the done thing for women to be scientists historically. In my field, it is actually quite a male-dominated field still, so this is actually a day-to-day issue for me. So at the sort of academic level, so that's, sort of PhD, postdoc and above, it's still 10% or less female in my field. So it's not unusual for me to be at a conference or a meeting or a lab and be the only woman. I actually stopped noticing it a number of years ago. But there's absolutely no reason in my mind why women can't do exactly the same work in science that men can. And in fact, I'm in many ways the wrong person to ask, because I love my field. I think the questions it asks are fascinating. I think the applications are really interesting. And there is no sort of cognitive reason why it shouldn't be accessible to women. So I think the desire for women to do science is there. And actually there's been studies showing that at younger ages, there's not much difference in the perception of whether girls can be scientists or not.
It'd be interesting to bring you in, Dave, just to get a sense in the classroom whether you see this it tends to happen or whether it's changing. What's your experience there?
Yeah, it is a big problem in education across our country that not very many girls are taking A-level physics. It's higher in biology and chemistry. But I do think Susie is exactly right when she tries to repeatedly make this point that science is a human activity, and somewhere along the line in the 20th century, it stopped being presented like that.
Right.
It hasn't been like that in the past, but one particular chap, Michael Brooks, who's a nuclear physicist, he describes it like this. The brand identity of science is reinforced with adjectives such as logical, responsible, trustworthy, predictable, dependable, gentlemanly, straight, boring, unexciting, objective, rational, not enthralled to passions or emotion, just a safe pair of hands. In summary, unhuman.
Right.
And I think that if you present science like that, you alienate a whole group of people, not just one particular gender, but a whole load of people who would make brilliant scientists if they were to realise that science is not like that at all. And one of the things that I try and do in my teaching is tell the stories that are associated with discoveries, which often have dead ends and disappointments.
And are very much linked to personalities. Of course.
And one of the consequences of that appears, has been that we have a lot more girls taking physics in our school than, I mean, at one point it was more than 20 times the national average.
Wow.
So I think communicating humanity and the real story of science brings a whole load of people to the table that wouldn't be there otherwise.
I was just going to say, I completely agree with Dave, and actually we met a while back and had almost exactly that discussion, and I was kind of like, oh, thank you, yes. You know, it's very much a human activity, and you know, we're doing something wrong in society to eliminate people who would otherwise be good scientists, ask good questions and enjoy the field. You know, I think we're really missing out by losing those people from the field.
Before time runs away too much further, because we must get into the substance of today's discussion, just be interested to know where, if you are willing to kind of nail your colours to this mast, where you sort of stand on the God thing yourself, Susie. Are you sort of agnostic? Is it something that's ever kind of come up in your science? I sometimes hear that some people see physics as the kind of place where you most likely run into those kind of metaphysical questions of what is ultimate reality and that kind of thing. But where have you come down in terms of your own religious perspective?
Yeah, so I think I've been through swings and roundabouts, I think. But if you ask me to pin down nowadays, I think I would say I'm an atheist. I guess I swing between agnostic and atheist, but it depends mostly on your definition of when you ask me about those two things.
Okay.
So I don't have a God hypothesis. Mm-hmm. I don't feel the need for one.
Do you ever kind of find that the stuff you're doing, the big questions obviously that physics sometimes poses about our place in the universe and where it all came from, does that ever kind of open a chink in the kind of the God question for you or not particularly?
Not for me. I think I wouldn't phrase it that way. I know that a lot of people who are religious, when they describe what it is about the universe that drives them towards confirming their faith in the existence of a God, they use words like wonder and amazement and, just marveling at the way the universe works. And even things like, you know, the equations we have to describe, say, quantum field theory and how all of that works, that actually it's quite elegant and beautiful. And we use words like that in physics a lot. That aesthetic sense is quite strong in physics, that the equations should somehow be beautiful. So I know for a lot of religious people, and actually in Dave's book, I think that helped me understand that position, that confirms their belief in God. But for me, that's an extra leap, which to me, I don't see the evidence for needing that extra leap. I think the world can be amazing and wondrous and marvelous, and it's incredible that it has a mathematical basis as well. But I don't personally feel the need to invoke the existence of a God to understand that is how the universe is.
I'm sure we'll come to talking about that in the course of time. But thank you, Susie, for being with us on the programme today. I've just been really enjoying hearing about your own area of science as well. And if you want more information on Susie or indeed my guests Dave and Tom today, do go to the link at today's programme page, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. You can listen back to today's show, share it on with others, subscribe to the podcast and much more besides. Do so, and do get in touch as well by email if you want to comment on anything you hear on today's programme, unbelievable@premier.org.uk. And of course, there's the Twitter and Facebook as well, at UnbelievableJB. For Twitter, facebook.com/UnbelievableJB if you want to get in touch via the Facebook page.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Well, today on the show, we're asking, does science need God? David Hutchings and Tom McLeish are co-authors of the new book, Let There Be Science, Why God Loves Science and Science Needs Gods. They believe the Christian worldview has fueled some of the biggest leaps forward made in science over the centuries. Well, coming on the sceptical side of today's show is Susie Sheehy, we were just hearing from Oxford University. Susie says, as a scientist herself, science is fundamentally a human activity, and we ought to examine the basic nature of what that means independent of faith. Got a really interesting programme for you today. Just before we get to the end of the first part of today's show, I wonder, David and Tom, if you could kind of talk about sort of some of the ways in which, or spell out briefly at least, one or two ways in which you make the case that science, to some extent, historically has been dependent upon belief in God, or that at least has really been the ground on which science has been done very often. Do you want to give a brief example of that, Dave?
Sure, yeah. So if you take, for example, I would find myself in a strange situation a couple of weeks ago, a bit of time to kill, not many options with which to kill it, and made a bad decision. I watched Gods of Egypt.
Oh, right.
Sorry if I'm not allowed to say things like that on the radio.
You are. It's fine.
Not recommended. In this film, there are this big collection of loads and loads of gods ruling over Egypt and the rest of the world. They are unreliable. They get into fights. They make mistakes. They can be tricked.
Temperamental.
They don't seem even remotely more impressive than the people they're ruling over. And if you factor that in, that some of them are in charge of rivers, some are in charge of fire, some are in charge of the stars or truth. Well, what kind of world does that produce? If Tom or Susie or I were to go into the lab and do an experiment and try and get some sort of result, even a simple experiment like boiling water and finding out, you know, what temperature does that happen at? We'd have no guarantee of what was going to happen, because we're requiring the god of heat, the god of water, the god of truth. Everybody's got to be playing along, if they're having affairs or having a fight or asleep.
It could really ruin your scientific experiment. Yeah,
and even if I get a result, I have no guarantee I'll have the same result the next day, because the next episode of the god's soap opera has kicked off. So you cannot have science as we would recognise it, in the scientific method as Susie is currently using it in Japan, if you think that the world is operated by chaotic systems, that good fighting evil all the time.
Which is the way a lot of religious systems historically have seen
kind
of the cosmic world.
Yeah.
Yes.
Whereas in Christianity, you have this notion of there being one supreme God, who's reliable, who's trustworthy, who is wise, who's dependable, who's created a universe for us to live in. That mind that created the universe has also created our minds. So we have this resonance there. So you get the scientific method coming out of, C.S. Lewis says, men became scientific because they expected there to be laws, and they expected there to be laws because they believed in a lawgiver.
Interesting. We'll come back to Tom as well for a bit more on that, and then come back to Susie. We're just coming up to our first break, though, and we're going to be discussing this idea of whether Christianity, unlike other religions that were around it at the time, gave a kind of a unique sort of view of the orderliness of our universe through God, upon which science was able to take place. I'm sure Susie will have something to say about that. You're going to be continuing to listen in the next section to our question, does science need God on Unbelievable Today? David Hutchings and Tom McLeish, authors of Let There Be Science, join me in studio. And Susie Sheehy, who's a physicist at Oxford University, on the line as well. And we're going to be continuing our discussion here on the show that aims to get you thinking.
If you want to have a massive reason why human beings are special, here it is. God became one.
We can be part of God's plan to bring hope to a hopeless generation.
We're living in an exciting time to be a follower of Jesus, the golden age of Christianity, ladies and gentlemen.
We live in a universe that has a story that is ultimately about love.
There's a God-shaped hole in the heart of every person. It can only be filled by God, made known through Jesus Christ.
Hear the world's leading Christian thinkers make the case for Christ at Unbelievable, the Conference 2017. Now available not only on DVD, but also as a digital download. Order online at premier.org.uk/shop.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Welcome back to today's programme. A really fun conversation today. Does science need God on the programme? We do science and faith a lot, actually, on Unbelievable, but I think this is a bit of a unique perspective, as represented in the new book, Let There Be Science, by David Hutchings and Tom McLeish. They are both Christians, and their book examines the story of science and the part Christianity has played. They believe the Christian worldview has actually fueled some of the biggest leaps forward made in science over the centuries. Well, on the more sceptical side, answering this question, does science need God, I'm delighted to also be joined by Susie Sheehy on today's programme. She's a physicist at Oxford University, says that science is fundamentally a human activity. She sort of vacillates between atheism and agnosticism, but says fundamentally this is a human thing. We don't need faith to understand it or do it. We just sort of started to open up one of the kind of central sort of ideas in the book there. David was saying that essentially Christianity was somewhat unique in coming and presenting a unified view of a God who is trustworthy, sets kind of an orderly, reliable universe into motion. And this was a framework upon which science then, in which you could trust that your results weren't going to vary from experiment to experiment, was able to happen. Tom, do you want to just add to this before we come back to Susie?
Yeah, perhaps it would be helpful if I said something that perhaps was unusual that attracted me to Christianity in the first place. So I may be a bit weird here.
Okay.
But there's a lot more than just there being an orderly God, a mind behind the universe that resonates with our minds. Consistent, but I'd be with Susie and say this wouldn't be enough to persuade me to believe in a God. The thing that actually got me attracted to Christianity is the honesty of people I knew who call themselves Christians about the world, there being things wrong, about there being evil and brokenness. And I have to say that a lot of my sort of secular friends, once I make up my minds, you know, what did I believe, really didn't have a persuasive account of why we balk at evil and why and suffering, and we want to call things absolutely evil. And there's something about the world which just doesn't seem right. And that turns out to be a story intimately entangled with a history of science in a fascinating way. And it all starts, so I remember reading the Bible, just as the Bible, just as literature worth reading a long time ago, and I came across the book of Job, which everyone should read. And in fact, a professor of philosophy at Berlin Einstein Institute, Susan Nyman, who is by no means a believer, says we should read the book of Job as a foundation for philosophy in the same way you'd read Plato.
It's one of the oldest books we have.
It's undateable, it probably is. And our relationship with nature is woven through it. So I'll cut straight to the chase. It's a long story, but eventually, after 37 chapters, God answers this suffering, complaining, righteous but distraught man Job with a poem. It's the most beautiful poem about nature I've ever read. Every stanza is a question, and God asks Job why the little cluster of the Pleiades is so close together, whilst the stars Orion are cast aside, where hail comes from, where ice comes from, why birds know how to navigate to the south. Just these questions. Now, Susie mentioned her experience of asking a question, how that unlocked for her the realisation that she could have a career in science. And of course, those of us who are scientists know that it's not the answers or getting the answers right that propel science. It's these beautiful, creative, unlocking questions. So from that point, I realise and it is right in the middle of the Bible, it's right in the middle of the wisdom literature, so-called, of the Bible. Jesus, the New Testament writers, knew this book backwards. It's our relationship with nature, and it's our relationship with nature that needs mending. Because if I, like Paul, you know, wanted to sum up the story of the Bible in a single soundbite, like a premier Christian radio soundbite, Paul would say, if he were sitting here and you asked Paul, you know, tell us about this crazy religion thing. Are you Jews? Are you atheists? Are you political misanthropes? What are you? He would say, tell you what, Joseph, we're in the business of mending broken relationships. So that's what he said it to the Corinthians. He calls it the ministry of reconciliation, doesn't he? But it means we're in the business of mending broken relationships. And who doesn't know about that? And one of the relationships that needs mending is our ignorant and mutually harmful relationship with the natural world that we start off. And here's the book of Job beginning to answer it. And a final historical tagline on this is, after being told and taught, actually, for my school days and early adult life, that early modern science, the great scientific revolution, was a victory of secular reasoning against a theological despond of the Middle Ages. I found that's an ahistorical, polemical, made-up story, that in fact the early great 17th century, the founder of the Royal Society, that I'm now, as you correctly said, work for, had a theological motivation for inventing experimental science that had to do with mending this broken relationship with nature.
Susie, I don't know if you want to chime in on any of the things that are being said here, but I mean, coming back to the original point that Dave makes about the fact that, in his view, Christianity kind of provided a sort of a worldview which posited that there is a rational, orderly universe out there created by a rational, orderly mind, if you like, that was quite distinct from the competing hypotheses, if you like, of multiple gods, you know, with their temperamental activities and so on. I mean, that may or may not be true, but does it make any difference for you as a scientist, you know, working in the 21st century?
I think I'm going to answer that rather how it affects me in terms of my belief or non-belief. So I find it really interesting to hear the perspective of people like Dave and Tom, having Christian belief. But obviously there are many other religions out there, and, you know, you've discussed ancient Egyptian gods, but there are many other religions which we have around at the moment, some of which have multiple gods, say, you know, Hinduism. Now, each of those also have a very strong history of science, effectively. So I think the premise that that science needs God, it's like, okay, well, I understand why you would make that argument as a Christian, but there are other religions out there, and yet somehow science has thrived through almost every one of these. Now, I'm not an expert on other religions other than, you know, as an atheist, I have, you know, tried to read around and try and understand different people's points of view and belief systems. So to me, it seems that what science needs to thrive is not necessarily a religious environment, although I'm willing to accept that, you know, there are historical precedents, which they detail beautifully in the book, where, you know, someone having deep religious conviction actually drove them to actually ask questions and try and answer it and develop many of the amazing modern scientific revolutions that we've had. But I do question the premise that necessarily needs to be from God. I'm not entirely sure of the argument it has to be a Christian God or just a God, but the argument appears to be that it ought to be a single loving God.
Let's ask this to Dave, maybe, because I think this is important to get out. Susie's question is, why your God, I suppose, Dave. You know, I mean, there's many different versions of God out there. It's not as though science is purely a Christian endeavor when it comes to different religions. What marks the God of the Bible per se out as being unique in this respect? I mean, do you argue that is the case, that there is a uniqueness to Christianity's relationship with science over and above any other religion?
Yeah, well, certainly with the monotheistic faiths and science, there's a much tighter religion. Where Susie's right is that definitely there's a really great successful history of technology amongst all sorts of different communities and religions throughout history. But technology and science are different to each other. So Susie is a particle accelerator physicist. She will be working with a team of people who build the stuff, and she's working on the laws of nature. Someone else is putting the stuff together, and they're different skill sets, and they require sort of different ways of thinking. But I mean, I can give examples of how, for example, Joseph Needham, who's a historian of China, you know, he says, concluding his sort of mammoth work through Chinese history, there was no confidence that the codes of nature's laws could ever be unveiled and read, because there was no assurance that a divine being, even more rational than ourselves, had ever formulated such a code capable of being read. So we don't see the discovery of natural laws in the same way in these other cultures. And we can even look at modern Japan, where Susie is now. There's a paper that came out last year, possibly earlier this year, on training teachers, science teachers. And it's an experiment you might remember yourself, Justin. getting a spring, hanging masses on it one at a time.
Yes, that one, yeah. Yeah,
the one where the teacher tells you you've got to wear safety glasses because it might spring back up and take your eyeball out.
This is GCSE level stuff, isn't it?
Oh, well, yeah. I mean, you can have a go at it now if you're feeling confident. And of course, what happens is that you write down how much longer the spring's got.
Yeah.
You draw your points, how much mass have you added, how much longer is the spring, and you get this succession of points. Mm. But once you've got those points, what do you do with them? And that actually turns out to not be as obvious a question or answer as you might have thought. And this study in Japan looked at what science teachers in Japan thought you should do and why.
Okay.
So they would draw a straight line, even if the points didn't lie exactly on a straight line.
Interesting. Mm-hmm.
And we would do that too, and I'm sure Susie would. Mm. But then they were asked, why? Why would you do that? Why do you override the actual results you've got with a theoretical straight line? And they were asked for multiple choice. It was asked as a multiple choice question. One of the options was the relation is the most effective expression of theory. In other words, you've done an experiment, but what you're really looking for is an underlying rule.
Okay.
So your points are guesses.
Yes.
Each point is a guess. And when you put them all together, it reveals to you some new secret about nature, where it's a straight line. But the second, one of the other options they were given was, well, if you did this experiment over and over and over and over and over again, and you look through history of everybody else doing it, then it would kind of average out into a straight line.
Okay.
Now, they might sound, perhaps to the untrained ear, exactly the same thing, but they're not. Mm. And in this report, the finding was put forwards that they just weren't looking for a law. There's no expectation in the Japanese worldview that there's an immutable law.
Underlying law.
Yeah.
They were just looking for a statistical kind of probability.
Well, it's even deeper than that. It is, here are where the points fell today.
Right.
So therefore, I'm going to show that. But you lose the guarantee that the same thing's going to happen tomorrow. And a couple of quotes from the paper. The results reveal that Japanese prospective science teachers conform to the Japanese traditional way of thinking, which has never laid a primary emphasis either on immutability or on universality, that the laws of physics are constant and that they're the same everywhere.
That's fascinating. And for you, then, the Judeo-Christian worldview is something that does have this at its bottom, that there is this kind of underlying world of immutable laws, which...
Yeah, and that is actually in the paper as well. It says, in the Western scientific way of thinking, appearance refers to something mutable and particular, but reality refers to something immutable and universal. This dichotomy is shared in the Western cultures through the Christian tradition.
So coming back to you, Susie, be first of all fascinating to hear if you think that's your experience of the Japanese culture and what that means.
Yeah, so I've worked in Japan a lot. I think the conclusions there are, to me, slightly odd. I would have to read the paper to understand in more detail exactly how they make those conclusions. I mean, I've worked in Japan, you know, for up to 1 or 2 months a year for about 5 years or more. So I'm fairly familiar with my colleagues here and their sort of underlying assumptions. I certainly don't experience that with them, but then I think, well, probably half of them would identify as non-religious. Mm. I think what might be coming through there is perhaps a misunderstanding of what their belief system actually is based on, or why it is that they're making those assumptions. So why is it that the universe shouldn't be immutable, or that laws shouldn't change one day to another, or something like that? And in fact, to me, that comes down to sort of a mindset of accepting things that are changeable, or having a sort of flexible mindset, which I know, at least from my very small experience of talking to Buddhist meditation teachers and things like that, is that that's actually something that's really valued here, is to have a flexibility of mind. And so being open to the fact that perhaps if you take the same data again another day, it's different, is is actually perhaps a good thing, right?
Sure.
Because perhaps your measurement is limited. So effectively, the response that they're giving to me says that they're taking the data at face value. I think the response that you read out there, the option, was a little oddly phrased, that it's, it's the best line that fits the theory. Who knows? I mean, I haven't read the study, so I don't know the details of it. But in my experience anyway, I see no huge underlying difference between, with their assumptions.
I mean, when it comes to the wider point, I suppose, is it fair, would you say, or would you accept the point that even as an atheist yourself, Susie, doing science, in the 21st century, your kind of view that there is this kind of intrinsic rationality and order and immutableness to the laws of nature is at some level, somewhat dependent on the Christian forebears in the past who sort of established that kind of a world view, which even as someone who doesn't share their religious perspective, you still kind of are working out of, if you like, as an atheist.
Oh, yes, I would absolutely accept that. And in fact, the premise that perhaps that's a good thing that's come out of Christian belief, I completely agree with. Creating a mindset, if you like, where you can say, oh, actually, there is all this stuff going on in the universe, but perhaps we can understand it. I think that's incredibly valuable. And in fact, the book that Dave and Tom wrote was very enlightening to me in terms of understanding how these different things are reconciled within someone who really believes in Christian faith. Because, from my personal point of view, I've been, as I said, through swings and roundabouts faith-wise. Mm. One of the questions that continually comes up for me, and maybe Dave and Tom can have a go at answering that, is it's about your assumptions and the premises on which you operate. So, we're discussing that you have this assumption that there's laws of nature, for example, and they operate the same all the time. But we know that's not true because we have quantum mechanics and randomness and chaos, and there are questions that cannot be answered. Mathematics tells us that there are questions that we cannot answer. So for me, with a religious faith, if you believe in a God, how do you not constantly pull that hypothesis into question along with all these other ones that have been pulled into question over time?
I think Tom's keen to have a go at that one. So let's pass the baton on to Tom.
Yeah, no, it's a lovely question to do with chaos and what we don't know. I'm a little bit puzzled about what Susie meant by mathematics telling us things that we don't know. Are you referring to Gödel's theorem there, Susie?
Yes, I mean, as an example, yes.
Right, well, of course, the amazing thing about Gödel's theorem, I think I would turn that back on you, actually, because what Gödel's theorem shows is that within any formal system, there are statements one can construct whose proofs one cannot construct. We can't prove them. But the amazing thing about Gödel's statements is that we, with our human minds, can see that they are true. So actually, it's a little bit kind of more
even
wonderful
though they're
than
kind
that.
Of unprovable,
but they're obviously true.
That's an interesting
that's
one.
The extraordinary. Anyway, but we could go down a rabbit hole there. I just thought that
I wasn't expecting to debate a Gödel's
incompleteness theorem. But here we are. You never know what these Premier Christian Radio debates take us to. But what I would say is the chaos and uncertainty. So if I go back to this, my wonder and delight at the poetry and the philosophy of the Book of Job being at the heart of the Bible, the subject that book tackles is precisely the question that Susie has just raised, which is you're looking around the universe and the world, and it looks chaotic, it looks unpredictable, it looks lawless. And in fact, my own physics, I'm a soft matter guys, I am made of soft matter, obviously, but the physics I study is also soft matter. And so statistical mechanics is the tool that I work with, which is a bit like Susie works with quantum mechanics. I kind of, if if I'm going to do a good Gödelian thing and rotate us 90 degrees in the complex plane, and we find we're on top of each other. But statistical uncertainty is right at the heart of what I do as well. And in a sense, what's driven my scientific passion for all my career is how order arises out of chaos. Mm. How in this seething, chaotic, Brownian molecular world of all our cells, nonetheless beautiful structures arise. And there is this mystery of order arising out of chaos. And there's something in the way that God and Job talk with each other, debate in that book, that tackles this question of how a fruitful universe is a universe that uses chaotic and random-seeming explorations to discover a universe of possibilities, what it's possible to be and what it's possible to do, that one can actually create through setting creation free and setting people free. Big, big theme.
So the kind of the questions that quantum theory throws up and the weirdness of it for you is not some kind of militate against a god of order and so on.
No, it's for me, it does the same as the discovery of evolution did for many Christians towards the end of the 19th century, when they said, "Oh, this is more like it. This is the sort of way that Yahweh, you know, the one creator God, would law, would create, would set a universe free to explore possibility, rather than sort of magically dictating things at different times."
Does that help at all, Susie, with that question you had?
I think my question was on a slightly different level, which is that, you know, there have been things which we've held to be true for a long, long time. And then, for example, science may have overthrown them. And all throughout the book, for example, there are discussions on how there have been questions asked. And then, you know, someone has, like in Job, I think it was actually talking about, you know, thought about it and had this conversation and somehow got a wider perspective and therefore, you know, learned something or changed their opinion or you know, and that is argued in the book as something which is, okay, this is quite a scientific way of thinking almost. It's taking in the world around you, coming up with a theory or a hypothesis, and then saying, okay, well, what's happening here doesn't fit my data, right? Mm-hmm. As you say with Job. And then... you know, sort of throwing that out and accepting a new one. But I think where my question was getting at was, we know that there have been things which humans have held to be true, and it has taken us a long, long time to understand the actual nature of reality around us, because sometimes it really confounds us. Yeah. At no point in the book did I ever see a way to step out of the box of still having the fundamental assumption that there is a God. I know that, you know, that's coming from an atheist. So I like that. Obviously my constant question throughout the book is, okay, this all works within your framework. But for me, I'm outside that framework.
And it's still working fine.
The wonderful thing actually for me is that I can take, you know, a lot of the ideas and the values and the understanding and things, and I love the book, don't get me wrong, but I can also take those ideas from Buddhism, I can take ideas from Hinduism, and then I get to decide, okay, what is it that works best for me?
Before we go to a break, just maybe time for David to just give a quick response, and time is flying by, I knew it would, but carry on, Dave. Yeah.
Yeah, Susie, I love the way that you're asking these questions, you know, and the thing is that this book cannot address everything, and it's a sort of self-contained unit where we're talking about the relationship between science and God, and I would say that belief, why am I a Christian? I'm a Christian because I have had a very real personal experience that's been going on for a very long time with a personal God. I believe that when the Bible lays down claims like you are potentially magnificent because you're made in the image of God, I feel like that's true. But at the same time, it says you're wretched because you're rebellious and you've turned your back. I feel like that's true. And then it says you're in desperate need of help to get back on the train. I feel like that's true. When it says you need forgiveness, when it says that there is this aspirational figure, Jesus, who is the God who made you, who is everything good, and who is offering to be your saviour and your friend and your guide and your God, that all just... It sits right, it resonates. But what I don't want to say is it's only that. So in other areas, I can find things that sit with it in history, in philosophy, in sociology, in my relationships with other people. And what this book is talking about is don't take that away from people who want to do science.
I guess in some ways it's a redressing the where the pendulum has swung to some extent in this conversation.
I mean, just to Susie again, we certainly are not saying is something as ridiculous as you have to be a Christian, you have to believe in God to do science. We are not saying
of course
that. And any more than you have to be believed to be a doctor or a good actor or a good home care or anything. There's this wonderful grace. And the point is that God gives us a choice. I think atheism, real atheism, is a very noble and interesting belief, a choice. It doesn't persuade me, but there's clearly a choice to make. The reason we wanted to write the book was not so much that question, but to say that people don't have to make that choice between science and faith. So many young people are being told that. We just wanted to write and say they don't have to choose between.
We're going to take another break and we'll be concluding what's been a really fascinating conversation today on Unbelievable. Does science need God? If you want to get in touch, don't forget you can email in unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Look forward to hearing what you made of today's conversation. We'll be concluding it in just a moment's time. He drew thousands to hear him. His stories are still told 2,000 years on, and his words are the most famous in the world. Jesus was a brilliant communicator. But why? In the latest Premier Christianity magazine, we reveal what he knew about your brain and how it can help you to communicate like Christ. Plus, Governor B asked whether culture needs to become more unpopular. We talk to the parliamentary priest, Rose Hudson-Wilkin, and find out how to be brave when the world is a war zone from a pastor at the centre of the Manchester attack. All that plus much more. Ask for your free sample copy at premierchristianity.com/freesample. Welcome back to the final part of Unbelievable. This is the programme where Christians and non-Christians get together every week to dialogue and debate and have conversations that matter. We'll be concluding the discussion today on whether science needs God in a moment's time. Just a reminder that after Unbelievable, you can hear The Profile with Alistair McGrath. I'll be sitting down for an in-depth conversation with him on his life and faith and, of course, his new book, which he was talking about on the programme last week with Colin Blakemore. And we've got some of your feedback to that programme. Probably going to save that up for next week as well. If you do want to listen to that program via podcast, The Profile, it's available, of course, from our website, premierchristianradio.com/theprofile, or just look it up on iTunes or whatever podcast software you listen to. Creation Fest is coming soon. It's happening from the 4th of August onwards. And if you want to be there while I'm at the festival, then make sure you're there on the 8th and 9th of August. I'm going to be speaking about the new book, Unbelievable, the book, as well as hosting a live stage discussion of Unbelievable. We've managed to confirm that we've got a member of the Cornwall Humanists joining me and Andy Bannister for that discussion. So we're hoping to air that programme, a live audience version of Unbelievable from Creation Fest, shortly after we've recorded it at the festival. But if you're able to come down to Wadebridge in Cornwall and join us there at Creation Fest, we'd love to see you there. Word about the book keeps on spreading. Unbelievable, the book, Why After 10 Years of Talking with Atheists, I'm Still a Christian, available at unbelievablebook.co.uk. Going to be appearing on Michael Brown's show out in the USA soon. If you're listening on Monday the 31st of July to his show, you should be able to hear me there. And thanks to all the lovely comments that have been coming in about the book as well. Had some more reviews on Amazon recently. You can check them out at the Amazon listings for the book. And loads of lovely comments that came in following that competition we had. I announced the winners last week of the five gave signed copies of Unbelievable, the book, and I read out the comments they gave. But we actually had many, many entries for that, and some lovely, lovely comments that were left about why people listen to this programme. Here's just a few of them that came in. Joseph Scarucci says, there seem to be two extremes. I'm a university student, and university is a thoroughly secular environment in which any mention of religion must be avoided. Then there's church life, where any thought of doubt must be hidden. Where was I to go? Unbelievable has become the place where I retreat. It's a place where doubt is discussed. It's a place where I can get both sides of the argument. I've been listening for about 3 years and I'm deeply indebted to this programme. Thank you for your service. Vicky said, I started listening to the show after my husband suddenly passed away in February, as my faith has been shaken so much by it. And yet somehow I'm still hanging in there and I'm not scared of facing difficult questions anymore. What an amazing thing to leave with us, Vicky. Thank you very much. Joel said, I enjoy listening to your podcast. I've been listening for just over a year and have gone back over the archive to listen to all the shows. I came onto this show to add evidence to my arsenal of topics to be able to talk about. I love the best arguments coming together. While I believe most of the time I automatically come down on the Christian side, there have been times where the atheist is a better debater, but to me, the fundamental premises are flawed. Thanks so much for providing this resource for all people, whether Christian or not, and showing how to have a cordial discussion about it. That certainly is part of the point, Joel. Thank you. Carrie says, I listen to Unbelievable because there's really no show like it. Every week, I get to hear both sides of the most intelligent Christians and non-Christians more than anywhere else. This show has strengthened my faith, probably more than any other podcast that I listen to. Keep up the great work. Ian says, hi, Justin. I listen to Unbelievable because I think that as a Christian, it's my duty to be able to answer questions that come against my faith. Even if I don't have the answers, your show helps me know where I can go and find them. And Jared says, I found out about Unbelievable after I just graduated from a Christian college. I was looking for a podcast that would go in depth on theology and other biblical topics. Luckily, I found this show. Unbelievable has helped me as a minister to better understand the agnostic and atheistic mindset so I can better minister to them. Love the show and would love to read the book. Well, I hope you still get hold of it, Jared, even though you entered and failed to win the signed copy. You can, of course, go and purchase a copy. Here's one from Scott. Says, I've listened to Unbelievable for about 4 years. Been an amazing help in showing me how to have productive conversations with doubters of the Christian faith, agnostics and atheists alike. Justin does a masterful job in leading the way in this difficult arena. For your information, I've already read the book and found it to be inspiring. As skillfully as the first 8 chapters were written, chapter 9 was even more so. An emotional and eloquent overview of the Christian faith. As a lifelong Christian, I found the whole work to be outstanding. To borrow from your subtitle for the book, after 4 years of listening to atheists on Unbelievable, I'm a more convinced Christian. Way to go, Justin. Oh, thank you so much. That's such lovely, lovely thoughts from several people there. Scott, thank you for that endorsement of the book as well. If you want to go and check it out for yourself and have a look at the free sample chapter we're offering on the website as well, I do encourage you to visit the book website, unbelievablebook.co.uk. Okay, more of your feedback to come after we finish up today's discussion.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Welcome back to the final part of today's discussion, and it's just been a real joy actually talking about this Does Science Need God question with David Hutchings and Tom McLeish, co-authors of the new book Let There Be Science, Why God Loves Science and Science Needs God. You should really go and get a copy of it actually. Just fascinating the way it lays out the story of science and how they believe the Christian worldview has fueled some of the biggest leaps forward in science over the centuries. And interacting with Dave and Tom on this question has been Susie Sheehy. She's a physicist from Oxford University. Her work takes around the world, actually. She's been talking to us from Japan on today's programme. But she's an atheist and says science fundamentally human activity. She completely accepts that there's been an important contribution made by the Christian worldview, but not one that she feels in a sense she has to be part of in order to do good science. And we've had some really interesting conversations around that whole area. I did want to bring in a quote, which I've always enjoyed. It's attributed to Werner Heisenberg. And it's this: the first gulp from the glass of natural sciences will turn you into an atheist. But at the bottom of the glass, God is waiting for you. You're familiar with that, I'm sure, Tom. Do you think that's a good way of putting it?
Apparently it's even better in German. In Glasfinstern ist Gott wartet für euch. And yeah, I mean, it always causes, I often bring that into talks I give, actually. Yeah. It always causes hilarity and love because, you know, there's a beer theology of God, and it's lovely. But of course, Heisenberg, I love Heisenberg's whole experience, actually. I'm trying to write a book about scientific creativity right now, and his extraordinary invention, you know, on this island. It came to him, he was exhausted, he was puzzled, he wasn't getting anywhere with atomic theory, and then he had this amazing realization: these mathematical objects, new mathematical objects, could be representing the things that we observe. Oh, it's just a beautiful story, and so he would know. And I think actually, an experience like that, where a whole new paradigm, a whole new way of understanding how the universe works, that mathematically grips your soul and opens up. It's like opening up a whole new vista, a valley, a glorious vision. There are points in science where I have to say the experience of discovery is so numinous, so unexpected, so breathtaking in its beauty that we can be shown these things. I'm not surprised he responded in that way, actually.
It's an interesting way of putting it, because I think for many people, science has been seen almost as the new religion, almost. Science as a new saviour, you know, when you think about it, it provides the answers we need, shows us where we came from, our place in the universe, could even grant us eternal life one day. I mean, David, before we come back to Susie, do you think that view of science as the new saviour is an issue? Can science do everything that many people are claiming it can do for us today?
I think science is fantastic. And I do think that we have the capability as human beings of finding out scientific explanations and descriptions of everything there is. So some Christians might say, we'll never find the origin of life, or we'll never be able to describe that tiny fraction of time at the beginning, or so on. But, you know, I would never say never.
Right.
There's been a lot of times in the history of science where we have said these things are beyond us, and then they turn out not to be, because we're so inventive. And but what I wouldn't say is that science answers the questions that we need in the same way that you've phrased it there. Science offers us mathematical and physical descriptions of the physical world we live in. But the questions that we really need the answers to, on a deeper level, cannot be answered within the science box.
Funnily enough, I recently did a show with Alistair McGrath and his latest book, and he had this very similar conversation with Colin Blakemore, neuroscientist, and they had this very conversation about whether science can sort of answer the so-called why questions compared to the how questions and so on. And that is interesting, that different scientists can take such a different view on whether these are important questions, whether these are fundamentally the kind of questions we are seeking to answer. I'd be interested to bring you at this point, Susie. Do you agree with Dave's point there, that science, there are some types of questions that science simply isn't suited to answer in that sense?
I completely agree, actually, and that's kind of where the human element comes in. I want to give you a quick quote, actually, from a book that I read recently, which is by this amazing woman called Krista Tippett. I don't know if you've heard of her. And it's her book called Einstein's God, Conversations About Science and the Human Spirit. And it's wonderful. And in her introduction, she's talking about the light appearing as both a wave and a particle. And she says, here's the key that made the discovery possible. How we ask our questions affects the answers we arrive at. Light appears as a wave if you ask it a wave-like question, and it appears as a particle if you ask it a particle-like question. And this is a template for understanding how contradictory explanations of reality can simultaneously be true. And I think that's a wonderful template for being able to hold in our minds at the same time the ability to ask scientific questions, which might be addressing one thing, and the ability to ask more, I think I would phrase them as spiritual questions, which address the larger complexities in our lives, which science can't necessarily always get at.
It's interesting stuff. It's been so interesting having you all on the programme to talk about the subject today. Susie, before you go, I mean, when it comes to these big questions, do you feel like the science you're doing is ever, I kind of asked this question at the beginning, confronting you with any of those types of questions that are actually about our sort of purpose, you know, meaning, those why questions? Do you find that those get answered perfectly well within your current sort of worldview that doesn't really need a God as an extra explanation for the awe, the wonder, and everything else that you obviously feel from the scientific endeavors you're doing?
So I think in my particular science, I think, you know, I'm very much on the side of the machines and the beams and how they're operating. And it's a very human endeavor in that I have to come up with the questions that I'm asking. Mm. But I, you know, so in my particular subfield, I'm not asking questions like where did the universe come from? Although in my studies of particle physics when I was a student, you know, we do address those kinds of questions. So physics as a field, yes, is definitely asking those questions, but they're asking them in a slightly different way. It's kind of more of a how question rather than a why
sure.
question. But I think what we have in common in asking those questions is you know, we're sort of enraptured by this mystery of how the universe works. And while there might be a different flavor of question of you know, how this works in terms of, you know, 1 + 1 = 2, we can still ask the question, well, why does it work this way? Hmm. And to me, that's kind of a wonderful mystery, and I don't have the answer to that, and I don't pretend to, but I also don't feel the need to definitively say that I have the answer to that.
Sure. Dave, would you say you definitively have the answer to life, the universe, and everything?
I would, actually, but
you haven't got time to explain it all now.
It's Jesus. Jesus is the answer to life. He's the way, the truth, and the life. But I didn't discover that by being very clever or being very worthy. And I think the way that Susie goes about life and asks the questions that she does with the warmth that she does, I really hope that she is led to the same answer.
Well, it's been great having you all, both in studio and on the line. Tom, thank you for joining us as well.
It's been a pleasure, thank you.
It's been really interesting. Again, Let There Be Science is the book. Why God Loves Science and Science Needs God. Lion Publishing is where to find it. You can find links, of course, from today's show to my guest, to the book, and, of course, to Susie's website as well, where you can find out more about her fascinating work with particle accelerators. But for the moment, it's been a real joy having you all on the programme. Thank you for joining me today.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Look forward to receiving your thoughts about today's programme, unbelievable@premier.org.uk. And you may have thoughts to add on last week's show as well, when we were also discussing God, science and meaning, morality and so on, between Colin Blakemore and Alistair McGrath. You can also, of course, get in touch via our social media, @unbelievablejb, to follow me on Twitter, get in touch that way, facebook.com/unbelievablejb, if you'd like to get in touch about the Unbelievable show on Facebook. Well, let's move on to talk about some of the rest of the responses to that recent show on abortion that we had, in which a former abortionist, that was Dr. Robinson Haywood, he had taken part in abortions until he became a Christian and gave it up, got into a discussion on the show with Dr. Wendy Savage, who has practiced over 10,000 abortions in her lifetime. Got an awful lot of correspondence on that, and tried to read out a good number of it last week. Here's some more of it this week. Joel in Saskatchewan. Say it fast, it'll sound right, he says. Says, greetings, brother, from another continent. An interesting thought experiment that I use when discussing when life begins and when someone boldly claims that life does not begin until after birth is this. Imagine I invented a ray gun that I could walk up to any pregnant woman and immediately shoot only the baby, not hurting the mother at all, and have the baby die and induce an abortion. What would be my crime? I'll leave it there, says Joel. Okay, thank you, Joel. Joey in Denver, Colorado, says, just listened to the abortion episode. First, I want to applaud you and your guests. I felt like it was a very civil conversation that remained contained in appropriate topics. It bothers me with pro-lifers who insist that the opposition doesn't care about the rights of children, while on the other side, pro-choicers accuse the opposition of not caring for women's rights. In my opinion, each side has valid, caring intentions that happen to lead to opposite sides of the debate. I think a first good step to approaching the abortion debate is for both parties to recognise there's no such thing as a quote-unquote good abortion. This statement doesn't mean that it should be outlawed. It just builds a bridge for both sides to recognise it's a difficult subject, and the circumstances that lead to abortion are never good, be that rape, underdevelopment, or even negligence in using protection. None of those circumstances lead to a quote-unquote good abortion. If both sides can recognise that, I think empathy is inevitable and collaboration can happen. At a women's march in January, I saw a sign that read, "Prayerfully pro-choice." That was a beautiful sign that recognised the moral grey area where this topic exists. Thanks for continuing to push the envelope with your topics and finding ways to bridge different perspectives in a civil way. Thanks for getting in touch, Joey. Paul says, in the dialogue between Heywood Robinson and Wendy Savage, Dr. Savage asserted that a human organism doesn't become a person deserving protection until birth. As I understand it, her rationale for this view is that prior to birth, the unborn individual is dependent upon and attached to one particular person, the pregnant woman. But so are some conjoined twins. So is an infant in an isolated area where only the mother, through breastfeeding, is able to provide nutrition and care. Indeed, it's not clear at all how dependency or physical connection can have any bearing on either the nature or the moral worth or rights of a human being. If Dr. Savage is going to hold to and base her life's work on the idea that certain members of our species don't matter like the rest of us do, and so we may dismember and kill them, then she better have at least a plausible justification for that view. She apparently does not. Really appreciate the show, Justin. Hope you keep it up for a long, long time. John Cummings in Pennsylvania says, long-time listener of the podcast, want to thank you for all the work you've done in over 10 years. Quick question. Dr. Savage mentioned the potential human life only ceases to be a fetus after birth. She later mentioned, I believe I'm quoting her accurately, if it's still attached to the mother, it's not a human life. So I guess that would mean that the baby, I mean fetus, who has been born, but the umbilical cord is still attached, is still not a human? Well, that can't be what she truly thinks or believes, right? My taking a pair of scissors to my son or daughter's umbilical cord for the 2 seconds it took me to cut it didn't suddenly make them human, did it? I suppose this is just a case of what the doctor said. She could not be convinced of a baby in the womb any more than I can be convinced that it's not human life in the womb. I appreciated the discussion between both doctors and yourself. Apologetics is something I've greatly enjoyed learning more over the last decade or so. It's made me a stronger Christian, and your show has helped in that. Thank you. Ryan got in touch on Facebook to say this is in regards to the abortion debate, specifically Dr. Savage's point that the unborn are only potential human life and not an actual human life. I think I have a unique perspective on this. As of July the 12th, I was a new father again with my second little girl. And at one time, I was pursuing a degree in medical illustration. So I have a fair degree of biology under my belt. So to the point, there are scientific standards as to what constitutes life. In short, living things have or are, firstly, composed of cells. Second, use energy. Third, have levels of organization. Four, regulate and have homeostasis. Five, grow and develop. Six, adapt to their environment. And seven, reproduce. All of these are evident at conception, except number seven, reproduction. However, that shouldn't be viewed as an issue to contend with, as all little boys lack the ability to reproduce until puberty. Nevertheless, no one would contend they're not alive. So, at conception, life is evident. Lastly, this life is distinctly a human individual. At conception, a fertilized egg has 46 chromosomes. These chromosomes, half from the mother, half from the father, are unique to that individual their entire life and are exclusively human. There are no other possibilities. As they're all human, then the unborn all deserve rights, including the most important, the right to life. Thank you for the continued excellence of Unbelievable. Thank you, Ryan. And Ian says, two very interesting recent programmes on abortion and science. One feature of the secularist humanist view in both programmes is how it belittles humanity. Wendy Savage is the most serious example of this, where it's essential to her view that an embryo or fetus is not a person. In the science programme, Colin Blakemore's view that everything can be explained by science seems to render all thought is essentially meaningless if it's just the product of scientific processes. This means that his own views have no intrinsic meaning. It's only in Christ that humanity finds its full value. So there you go. Some more of the various emails that came in on the abortion debate. Still welcome to put your views in as well. If you haven't got around to listening it or have only just listened to that debate, we always encourage your emails after the fact as well. unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Look forward to hearing what you want made of it. Let's go to one or two other emails that have come in recently. This was lovely from Wade Austin Padgett. He was a guest on the program probably about 3 years ago now. He's partially sighted, is Wade. He's a sceptical, atheistic, perhaps agnostic, more accurate, listener of the show. And he read an article that I put up on the Christianity Magazine website about the background of the show, why Unbelievable is what it is, where it came from, and all of that sort of thing. It's available still from the website, premierchristianity.com. He read the article and sent him this email. It said, Justin, I first want to express how appreciative I've been of the particular format that you utilise and what, for all intents and purposes, has seemed to me an effort made in the best of faith. In the nearly 8 years that I've listened, albeit not necessarily as regularly as I might have, and the marvellous opportunity we had to speak on air, I've only ever felt a sense of welcoming without what would often be the sense that, as an atheist, I was going to be used as a foil for another Christian argument. It happened here on a local Christian station that I've been asked to speak on. The reasons for your success from an atheist perspective, well, you go on to give four. Firstly, civility and compassion as foundational values. Whether those values derive from your faith or simply from good secular sense and warmth seems irrelevant. They are valued and they keep you solid. Second, while there's certainly an expectedly Christian slant, no one needs to wonder whether or not you yourself are a Christian, that you engage honestly and deeply with your guests. That's apparent. Thirdly, intellectual rigour. A show like Unbelievable has its limits in this domain, but I think that you've done as well as you can have with what you have, which is to say, marvellously. I've often been disappointed by guests on both sides, but as someone who's been sought after by Christians for the sake of my criticism of my own atheist community, I have to say that it's perfectly proper to, if disappointing, to see one of my own fall on his face at the feet of a Christian interlocutor. It's necessary and something that we usually see hidden away on other broadcasts that may bring atheists and the low-hanging Christian fruit together. And fourth, finally, just plain warmth. Just in this particular product of human interaction is likely about as close to a religious experience as I will ever get again. Whether we choose to call it love, reverence, depth of feeling, whatever, it's something that I hear through my earbuds and something that I felt talking with you over a milky tea at Tony's. That is always appreciated. And whether Christian, atheist or agnostic, it's something that we need to make more of. Hope that you and your Christian listeners who may be framing your article in evangelistic terms also understand these points as I've made them. You give us a good experience, and it's good because of the connections that we witness, and for those of us fortunate enough, get to experience in person. Thank you, Justin. Thank you, Wade. I was very touched by those comments left underneath the article when I posted it to Facebook about the way the show has developed over the years and so on. And you referenced Tony's there, the milky tea at Tony's. That was my number one eating establishment for many, many years here at Premier Towers, just opposite our studios. The cafe known as Tony's. Unfortunately, it's been closed now for a good year and a half, which is a great shame. I have to walk a little bit further to get sustenance now than just over the road. But I'm glad you've got good memories of it, Wade. Thank you for getting in touch with the programme. Well, that's about all we've time for on the show this week. It'd be good to get a good bit of feedback in this week, though, wasn't it? We've got lots of other exciting things coming up for you over the summer, though. And I can tell you we've got shows coming up on politics, on Islam, on near-death experiences and out-of-body experiences, the Creation Fest debate that we're going to be having. So much to look forward to. And, of course, I just this last week recorded with Alvin Plantinga, who's being awarded the Templeton Prize this year, and had a flood of questions for him after putting it out on last week's show and on social media. And you'll be able to hear that later on in the summer as well. So lots to look forward to here on Unbelievable. Let me tell you, though, what's coming up as of next week.
You're unbelievable.
Well, a complete change of gear. Does archaeology support the Old Testament, we'll be asking, specifically when it comes to the story of Moses and the Exodus? This isn't something we've ever really covered on the show, but Ted Wright, who's from Epic Archaeology, will be our Christian guest, arguing for the historicity of the Old Testament from archaeology. He'll be opposite Bible skeptic Bob Price. So come back again for the show that gets people talking every week here on Premier Christian Radio. Coming up next, I'll be with Alistair McGrath on The Profile.
Lo sabe que ahora más que nunca buscas el precio más bajo. Por eso, cuenta con nuestra garantía de precios bajos para obtener lo que necesitas a precios competitivos para tus proyectos. Y si encuentras un artículo igual a un precio más bajo que califica, te lo igualaremos. Lowe's. Nosotros ayudamos. Tú ahorras. Igualación de precio aplica al artículo igual con un precio actual en tiendas calificadas. Aplican términos y exclusiones. Detalles en lowes.com/garantía-precios-bajos.
Why is life better with American Family Insurance? Because every policy comes with something very special. A trusted agent who's there to help protect your dreams by finding the right coverage at the right price. Save up to 23% when you bundle home and auto. American Family Insurance. Get a quote and find an agent at AmFam.com.
Products not available in every state. Visit AmFam.com to learn how discounts may apply to you. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.